Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin, and we're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, January the 10th, 2018. We start with the triangulator. Murder most foul. Last year brought good news for the country's largest city. New York, that epicenter of commerce and culture, once hobbled by the crack epidemic, an economic crisis, declining population, and a wave of violence, has seen a frankly incredible drop in crime. Since the 90s, homicide and street crime tallies have dropped by 90%, even as the city's population expanded to 8.5 million residents. Which got us thinking, what did our local city's murder rates look like in 2017, and how did they stack up against other major metros? As it turns out, both Raleigh and Durham are above the national average. In Raleigh's case, barely, but they're still safer than many other big cities. Here's what the graph looks like. Murders by city, and the numbers given are per 100,000 residents. St. Louis had 66. Baltimore, 56. Detroit, 40. New Orleans, 40. Kansas City, 31. Philadelphia, 20. Atlanta, 17. Houston, 12. Charlotte, 10. Durham, 9. Los Angeles, 8. Portland, 4. New York, 3. Seattle, 3. North Carolina as a whole, 6.7. And the USA overall, 5.3. And then looking at Raleigh and Durham only. In 2008, Raleigh had 34, Durham had 24. In 2009, Raleigh was 14, Durham was 20. In 2010, Raleigh was 14, Durham 22. In 2011, Raleigh 17, Durham 27. In 2012, Raleigh 17, Durham 21. In 2013, Raleigh was 12, Durham 27. In 2014, Raleigh was 16, Durham 22. In 2015, Raleigh was 16, Durham was 36. In 2016, Raleigh was 24, Durham 36. And in 2017, Raleigh was 26, Durham was 22. The next article, Councilmania. If all goes to plan, the Durham City Council should have its seventh member in about a week. If you haven't been following along, an at-large seat opened up when Steve Shule was elected mayor. The seat carries a term that expires in 2019. 22 people applied and passed the basic eligibility requirements. Last week, the council narrowed the field down to 7 finalists. There is more than one candidate on this list who would be an excellent council member that I could support, said Shule. I think this group would make an excellent city council, added council member Charlie Reese. Among the finalists are 3 women hoping to represent Durham's Latinx community and 2 people who ran in the recent municipal election. Here's a quick rundown. Pilar Roca Goldberg is president and CEO of El Centro Hispano and a member of the city's Gang Reduction Steering Committee. Sheila Arias, who owns a cleaning service, works as a parent leader at the State Department of Health and Human Services and works with a grassroots group, Moms Rising. Javier Caballero is a program coordinator with an education consulting firm and a member of the Durham Open Space and Trails Commission. Carl Rist, Senior Director of Prosperity Now, a think tank that focuses on addressing economic inequality, chairs the People's Alliance Economic Inequality Team, and helped launch the Durham Living Wage Project. Corrine Mary Haldeman is an activist and community organizer who works to prevent gun violence and advocates for stronger gun policies. Sheila Ann Huggins is an attorney and a former city employee of 9 years who ran for the Ward 3 seat in the recent municipal election, placing second to Vernetta Alston. Piers Freeland, a professor, musician, and community organizer who started Black Space, ran for mayor in the recent municipal election, and came in third. Council members each named their top seven applicants, and those with the most votes were selected as finalists. Of all the applicants, three appeared on every council list: Rocha Goldberg, Rist, and Haldeman. The council will hold a public input meeting at 7 p.m. on January 10th, in which each candidate can have supporters speak on his or her behalf for 15 minutes. The candidates themselves won't be able to speak during that meeting. They'll be interviewed by the council the next night in a meeting at City Hall that begins at 5 p.m. The council plans to vote on a new member immediately before its January 16th meeting. The next article, Ordered Out. Despite a looming deportation order, Wilton Acosta is trying to stay optimistic and says he'll appeal once more. He's been fighting his case for 2 years since he was picked up by immigration agents outside his Durham home while on his way at class at Riverside High School. After asking for a continuance, Acosta expected to head back to Charlotte immediately to the immigration court last week. But instead, he was ordered removed from the country and sent back to his native Honduras. He has until January 11th to appeal the order, and he intends to do so, citing a pending visa application seeking lawful status now that he is married to a U.S. citizen. "I remain faithful in God that things will turn out for the better," he said during a press conference. For those who have supported Acosta along the way, the past 2 years have been a roller coaster of uncertainty, fear, victories, big and small, and waiting for the shrouded, drawn-out process to take its course. This was not the outcome they had hoped to see. Acosta's classmates and teachers at Riverside rallied around him throughout his class, even traveling to Washington, D.C. to lobby on his behalf. Local elected officials have also written letters of support, asking for the removal proceedings to be halted. A deportation would not only rip the 21-year-old from his parents and his new wife, but it would also send him back to a country just as dangerous and perhaps more unstable now than in 2014 when he fled threats from gang members who had targeted him for his Christian beliefs. Although the country's murder rate has been falling in recent years, Honduras is still considered one of the deadliest places in the world outside of a combat zone. At least 31 people have died amid protests that broke out following a contested presidential election in last November. We turn now to the news section. Neglect your elders. In 2016, North Carolina nursing homes were fined $3.4 million for failing to protect vulnerable residents. The Trump administration is putting the brakes on that. People who live in nursing homes often have trouble speaking up for themselves, so the government has long spoken up for them. But the power of that voice is growing weaker under a new policy direction from the Trump administration. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has maintained strict federal oversight of nursing homes in return for the Medicaid payments that cover most nursing home care. Sometimes this has meant fining centers that fail to protect vulnerable residents, then let too much time pass before fixing dangerous conditions. Bill Lamb, executive director of Raleigh-based Friends of Residents in Long-Term Care, and other advocates for older people, say that nursing corporations tend to look at fines as the cost of doing business, but they still want to reduce them. The regulations in a business environment are considered a restraint of trade, Lamb says. What they want to say is, there's something fishy about that number. The reality is, they got dinged because they did something wrong. President Trump's administration recently responded to nursing home industry pressure, announcing changes that include a moratorium on imposing penalties in such areas as prescription of psychotropic drugs, access to behavioral health care, and a resident's baseline care plan, meaning a written assessment of the person's status upon entering the facility and plans for treatment. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services will use this 18-month moratorium period to educate surveyors and the providers to ensure they understand the health and safety expectations that will be evaluated through the survey process, wrote David R. Wright, director of CMS Survey and Certification Group. The decision departs from an Obama-era policy of levying heavier fines against nursing homes for violations that cause or should cause death or could cause death or serious injury caused immediate jeopardy. In the last year of the Obama administration, these penalties increased from $50 million in 2014 to $90 million in 2016. Kate Goodrich, Director of Clinical Standards and Quality for the CMS, offered this rationale for the change in statement. Rather than spending quality time with their patients, the providers are spending time complying with regulations that get in the way of caring for their patients and doesn't increase the quality of care they provide. Throughout North Carolina, 87 nursing homes were hit with a total of $3.4 million in fine, an average of about $40,000 per incident. In 2016, the most recent year for which totals are available, with more than 400 nursing homes licensed in the state, that means about one in five facilities were slapped with fines in a single year. They can penalize them. They can disqualify the facilities from Medicaid or Medicare, says Steve Guggenheim, a Raleigh lawyer who specializes in nursing home cases. In terms of a form of recoupment or a penalty, it amounts to a slap on the wrist. But it is, at least, a public slap on the wrist. As Guggenheim points out, people who research nursing homes for themselves or their relatives can get a clearer picture of a center's performance by checking penalties at nursinghomecompare.gov. This site provides consumers with a federal star rating system that allows them to get a tentative idea of a facility's quality. In one example, before the new policies took effect, federal authorities fined Longleaf Neuromedical Treatment Center, a nursing home in Wilson, about an hour's drive east of Raleigh, $243,407 during 2017 for failing to take adequate care of residents. Most of that amount stemmed from an incident in which a Longleaf resident, unnamed in records, though described by state investigators as having a history of being paranoid and suffering from hallucinations that he is fighting demons, walked out of a malfunctioning alarm-equipped door, then ran away from the facility on May 18th. The resident was found crossing the highway and running down the grassy median between the north and southbound lanes, a state report reads. After a long internal and regulatory process, Longleaf installed new equipment and completed staff training designed to prevent future elopements, as such walkaways are known. Following another similar incident, a Chapel Hill facility, Signature Healthcare, was fined $127,340 in April after a resident walked away. In this case, though, the resident eloped not once, but twice in the space of a few minutes. Staff at the center had noticed disorientation, confusion, and combative behavior from the resident. After the confused, disoriented resident had been outside for about 8 minutes, someone, perhaps a passerby, came inside and apparently alerted staff members. At that point, the nursing assistant brought the man inside by pushing him in his wheelchair. Had either of these incidents happened under the Trump administration's new policy, the facility wouldn't have faced penalties. Reports of these sorts of incidents will still be investigated, but for at least 18 months, the offending centers will neither be fined nor have the violations appear in public records. The industry is pleased. Last year, the American Healthcare Association, a nursing home trade organization, issued talking points for its members to use in an effort to reduce federal fines, called civil monetary penalties, or CMPs. Use of CMPs has skyrocketed, with surveyors using CMPs retroactively to punish providers instead of using them to correct behavior. The trade organization's suggested language reads, "These changes come at a time when skilled nursing sector quality is better than ever. Staffing levels are increasing. Rehospitalizations are decreasing. And skilled nursing facilities are doing better on metrics measured by CMS." The incidents that draw fines are often rooted in failures in alarm equipment and/or a lack of training for staff. Remedying either costs money, a direction that some nursing homes avoid if it hurts the bottom line, Lamb says. "The reality is, healthcare is a business," Lamb said. "A major part of quality has to do with staff and training and personnel costs. When you are in the business to make a profit, there are only a couple of ways you can cut costs. It's either in your billing or in your personnel." The next news article, The Waiting Game. Durham sheriff wants plenty of notice before you protest. Durham is a place where, in a matter of hours, hundreds of people will gather downtown in the middle of a workday in 100-degree heat to stand up to the Ku Klux Klan and end up having a block party complete with a drum circle. So it should come as no surprise that a proposed requiring notice for some protests on Durham County grounds is meeting with resistance. The proposal would require 48 business hours notice for demonstrations involving 50 or more people on areas outside county buildings. If notice isn't given, the county manager could determine that demonstrators are trespassing and have them removed. Authority the manager already has. The ability to respond to current events in real time and the importance of people immediately after learning of a policy enactment or proposal, being able to voice their opinion about that in the streets, is a necessary part of our democracy, says Susanna Birdsong, policy counsel for the ACLU of North Carolina. "The immediacy is important because it's what the Constitution requires. Forcing people to wait 48 hours before voicing an opinion on the matter of the day could be too late, and it just isn't necessary." The proposal follows a letter by Sheriff Mike Andrews in response to an August 18th anti-Klan rally downtown. In it, Andrews asked for guidelines for demonstrations on county property. Wilmington, Goldsboro, and Raleigh are among the cities that require a notice of intent to picket, as they call it. Goldsboro asked for 72 hours notice for a crowd of any size to picket. Wilmington and Raleigh both require notice of any protest involving 10 or more people, although their ordinances don't specify when that notice needs to be submitted. Raleigh's ordinance would was upheld in 2008 by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which said it didn't place a significant burden on protesters or give officials discretion to restrict speech. Part of a policy in Long Beach, California, that required 24 hours notice, however, was deemed unconstitutional on the grounds that it regulated events regardless of whether or not they would interfere with vehicle or pedestrian traffic, and therefore could restrict speech beyond what is reasonable to maintain order. The policy being proposed in Durham is modeled after one on the books in Charlotte since 2004, with one key difference. Charlotte's policy also requires notice 48 hours ahead of an event, while Durham proposed call for 48 business hours of notice. This means that protesters who want to respond to something that happened on a Saturday could have to wait until at least Wednesday to do so. During a board meeting this last week, Commissioner Heidi Carter voiced the strongest objection, saying the policy was unnecessary and could stir up discord. But County Attorney Lowell Seiler and Jody Miller, General Manager of Community and Public Safety, said the policy was needed to ensure the safety of both demonstrators and people using county facilities. The policy isn't intended to stifle speech, they said, and couldn't be used to deny permission to any event. But the policy could conceivably give county officials sufficiently heads up to shut down a protest once it begins. We always worry about how things are going to be enforced and what it looks like, who will be targeted and who won't, anytime there is discretion in enforcement, Birdsong says. Because the proposal comes as an update to the county's facility use policy, which is approved by the county manager, amending it is an administrative decision that doesn't require approval from commissioners. County Manager Wendell Davis said staff members would attempt to bring a revision of the policy back to the board to satisfy commissioners' concern, but it's unclear when that will happen. The next article, the gentrifiers. John Little and other developers are remaking Durham's East End one house at a time, and they're not about to apologize for it. A year ago, the house on the corner of Dowd and Hazel Street was a squat green cinder block building, a simple duplex with a gable roof on a block lined with durable, humble homes. One unit was boarded up, while the other was in barely habitable conditions. Today, the structure is almost unrecognizable. It's now a single-family home capped by a metal Dutch hip roof the cinder block is clad in. There's a stucco atop a field base, and the backyard is gated and also fenced in. That transformation took exactly 72 days. Builder John Little purchased the house for just under $100,000 in September and rapidly set about renovating it. The house sold long before construction was finished. Someone came by and was interested, said Little. He didn't even blink at the price. That price? $350,000. The newly flipped house stands out, but only somewhat. Across the street is a brand-new two-story Craftsman that's still on the market. A block over is another house that Little built earlier in 2017. And all throughout this community are homes in the process of being demolished, renovated, or built, often several per block. It's a stunning metamorphosis for a neighborhood that only a couple of years ago was largely home to poor people. This is East End, that subset of Northwest Central Durham framed by North Roxborough Street and East Gear Street, Alston Avenue, and Canal Street. Lying just north of Cleveland Holloway, it's always been a lower and working class African-American neighborhood, but it's also just 20 minutes by foot from downtown, which makes it desirable in the current housing market. Little is far from alone these days. At least a dozen developers are doing exactly the same thing. This little neighborhood isn't the only one experiencing such a rapid shift. Some of those builders are also working in Southside, the neighborhood across from the Durham Freeway from the American Tobacco campus. But that's a smaller community, one that's almost reached capacity. East End is much larger, with one block after another block of small homes that could still be renovated or demolished. The human toll is real. The people who lived in the house at Dowd and Hazel Streets are gone. They moved a few blocks east to the other side of Alston Avenue. Little by little, many other low-income residents who used to fill the community are disappearing, going, saying, remaining neighborhoods, wherever they can. Naturally occurring affordable housing in neighborhoods like East End is vanishing under the seemingly unstoppable force of gentrification. It's easy to fault the developers and investors who had an early understanding of Durham's dynamics and are taking advantage of them for a profit. But they see themselves as providing a needed service and helping to clean things up along the way. In fact, they say, most of the houses have been demolished, were in such abominable condition, they were barely livable. I know people think I'm the gentrificator, says Little, but we're all part of the same hypocrisy. Only a few years ago, the city was desperate to improve neighborhoods like East End. The situation that led to the changes here and in other Durham neighborhoods is complicated. No one and everyone is to blame. According to the 1980 Durham Architectural and Historic Inventory, East End was built in the early 20th century in response to waves of African Americans moving to Durham to work in the mills. It was a working-class neighborhood, and the houses were built with simple materials. Dowd Street, the spine of the community, was soon lined with thriving businesses, restaurants, barbershops, grocery stores, laundromats. Through the 1950s, the neighborhood was populated by teachers and factory workers who owned their homes. But the next generation, their children, didn't stay, said Michael Jones Jr., owner of LSD Jones & Sons Funeral Home, which has sat at the corner of Dowd and Elizabeth Street since 1935. Then it became a neighborhood of rentals. Some houses stayed in the families, but often the owners lived far away and became absentee landlords. Others sold their properties, allowing some local landlords to amass dozens of properties. What that meant in practice was that many of the houses weren't maintained. Some landlords did let their properties run down where they thought they had regular maintenance in place. It wouldn't have gotten to that point, says Constance Stansel, director of Durham's Neighborhood Improvement Services. As the neighborhood became poorer, crime crept in and flourished. This was the wild, wild west, a jungle, says Dottie Malone, who lives on Gray Street and grew up in the community. Her neighbor across the street, David Downey, agrees. It was pure hell. A lot of shooting, he said. People would be sitting out right there on the curb selling drugs. NIS wasn't created until 2006, and by that time, the housing stock was in terrible condition. Even just 4 or 5 years ago, as council remembers, there were over 500 vacant or boarded-up properties in downtown neighborhoods. But then things finally began to change. The city launched an initiative in Southside, helping to fund new housing there, and the investment lured market-rate builders to the neighborhood. Meanwhile, downtown Durham was blossoming, and developers began eyeing the nearby East End. It's kind of an investor's dream, says Silas Mack, director of the Durham Community Land Trustees. It still has a great deal of housing stock available at a reasonable price, or at least it did, until recently. Indeed, landlords have woken up to the neighborhood potential, sensing that this might finally be their chance to cash out. John Little bought three properties, including the house with the purple door, from a Durham native who owned roughly 40 units. He's been offered properties by several other landlords in the area, and prices are starting to climb. It all happened so fast that the city has barely had a chance to swivel around from its prior focus of bettering the area. There have been all kinds of inventions to improve the neighborhood over the years, says Peter Skillers, director of Durham's Reinvestment Partners, a nonprofit that advocates for economic justice and prosperity. Now it's the exact opposite. The city now wants to figure out how to help the low-income residents who are suddenly being displaced. In East End, longtime residents have a range of reactions. Homeowners seem keenly aware of the changes. "Everyone who grew up here is gone," says Latif Stokes, who lives on Elizabeth Street in a house his grandfather bought decades ago. "A lot of people didn't own their homes. On the bank took their house, or they got bought out. If you live here on a fixed income, how can you afford it when the taxes increase? And they are increasing." The property taxes on his own house jumped by almost 25% since 2015 and 2016, from $1,600 to almost $2,000. Other properties in the areas have seen increases of close to 50% during that time. Those amounts are based on the whole house's rising appraised value, which are likely to continue to go up in the coming years as the neighborhood changes. A few blocks north on Dowd Street, Coy Sanders has been using materials he finds at demolition sites to improve his own house. Still, he's upset about the area's rebuilding and says others are as well. "You know they're angry. The houses they tear down, many were duplexes, somewhat affordable. Now they're putting back single-family homes," Sanders says. "The city couldn't have done more to help. They could have improved the housing, gave out grants, helped older people refinance." But many renters, arguably the hardest hit by the neighborhood changes, seem unconcerned. "I'm not worried," says Ricardo Morales, who lives at the corner of Gray and Gurley Street with his wife and four kids. "There are other places." He admits, though, that it might be tough to find a house as cheap as this one, a four-bedroom that goes for $650 a month. And Walter Parker and Lisa Miles, who rent a gray and turquoise cinder block house on Dowd Street, say they're not anxious either. "Our rent man said he won't sell," says Miles. Actually, their landlord sold the house 2 years ago to an investor for $175,000. Miles and Parker says in that home are likely to be denumbered. Driving around the neighborhood with John Little is an education. "Check that out," he says from behind the wheel of his truck, pointing to the foundation of an old house on Dowd Street. "That's pillar construction. The water runs right under the house. It soaks the soil, then the ground compacts when it dries, and it pulls the house down with it." He gestures at the cracks in the foundation that have resulted and the line of condensation that indicates a damp crawl space. Nearby is a newly renovated house. "That's a jackleg job," he said. "I wouldn't have done a 15-year shingle roof like that. That's the cheapest shingle you can possibly get." Little is as good a housekeeping inspector as determining the state of a structure. His living depends on his ability to assess whether a house is worth buying and renovating or whether he should tear it down and rebuild. Like a lot of solo builders, Little is something of a cowboy, personable, confident, opinionated, a redneck with a brain by his own account. "I have no life. This is what I do," he said. "I ride the neighborhood every day. I have to know what's going on." These days, Little, who was recently caught up in a controversy about a local horseshoe pit, horseshoes and hand grenades, that appeared November 8, 2017, is one of many builders in the neighborhood, Others include Mike Foley and his realtor wife. Transition Renovations, Pegas Land Company, which recently replaced an exceedingly modest house on Gray Street with a pair of townhouses priced at $400,000 each. Sandy Spear, one of the few women developers working in the area, and the biggest one, Thayer Homes, which has dozens of houses under development. But Little is still doing quite well for himself. At the beginning of 2017, he bought a vacant piece of land at the corner of Dowd and Gearwood for $80,000, built a three-bedroom house on it, and sold it this past summer for $430,000. Even given the rising cost of construction materials, prices went up significantly last year. Now that's a handy profit. The price isn't everything. Little says he'd like to keep his prices lower to remain within what he calls the target range of the millennial, roughly $350,000 by his count, and he'd rather save an old house when he can. But the profit margin on a renovated old house is much slimmer than that on a new construction, simply because the home can't be marketed as new. Plus, he says, many of the houses are simple in really bad condition. He drives around to make his argument, pointing out homes with off-kilter, load-bearing walls, signs of black mold, and vinyl siding concealing asbestos panels. His argument is that most of the area's homes were allowed to deteriorate over time, to the point where they can't be considered safe housing for anyone. Stancil, the NIS director, disputes that so many of the houses need to be torn down. It's not the case that the houses were in terrible condition, he said. But Terry Thayer, who runs Thayer Homes with his wife Christy, agrees with Little. His company has built 20 homes in the South Side and is now active in East End. He tried a few renovations, but they weren't worth the effort. All the homes he purchased were rentals, he said. I don't think I bought one from a one-owner occupier, and they were in abysmal condition. We were seeing a lot of termite damage, foundation damage. A lot of these houses, we find nothing but raw sewage under the house because the sewer line had rotted out and we're dumping it into the crawl space. He now does only new construction. Thayer admits his homes and their new inhabitants have changed the communities. But is that a bad thing? He's helped homeowners increase the value of their homes and has improved the neighborhood. Like East End, South Side was another notorious crime spot. Sure, residents have been displaced, but the houses weren't fit for human habitation, he said. And both Thayer and Little swear that most of the renters who lost their homes simply moved a few streets over. Thayer says he didn't expect the market in the two neighborhoods to take off like it has, but demand is now driving his business. The buyers are demanding a high-quality product, he said. Our product went from hardwoods on the first floor and carpets upstairs to hardwoods throughout, high-energy efficient homes, digital audio systems throughout. Kyle said you can run off your smart device. We're just listening to our buyers. And in East End, he says, buyers want bigger and more expensive homes. His company is building a house on Elizabeth Street that will be 2,800 square feet, super high-end, with a price tag in the 600,000s. A nearby house recently sold for $550,000 with several offers before construction was finished. An under-construction house on Mallard Street will come with an elevator to access its three stories. Indeed, the median listing price in that zip code has more than doubled in 3 years, according to Realtor.com. Who are these buyers? 90% are techies, says Thayer. 70% work from home. 100% are millennials. The housing market, Thayer admits, has gotten absolutely out of control. he'd actually like to drop his prices, but land costs throughout East End have gone way up, and the going rate for a plot that might be a sixth of an acre is now $100,000 or more, compared to less than half that just a couple of years ago. In essence, Thayer and Little have become victims of their own success. Little thinks city officials are happy about East End transformation, despite the ongoing gentrification, even if they're loath to say so. Secretly, the city council and everyone wants it to get improved. They just don't want to get the blame, he said, mentioning appreciative comments he's received from local police. But Durham policymakers say that's not the case. Rather, the question is how to revitalize a neighborhood or a city without the displacement of people or the destruction of houses is simply a quandary no one has yet figured out. The market forces are real, says Mayor Steve Shewell. We're not going to beat the market forces, but we can sure make a difference. Shewell cites the city's focus on creating new affordable housing, a central plank of his mayoral campaign, and he also alludes efforts to stabilize existing neighborhoods. In particular, he mentions a new program enacted a few months ago that provides property tax relief in certain gentrifying neighborhoods, including both East End and South Side, and another that will help lower-income homeowners repair their homes at a low cost. That could help lessen the displacement of low-income people, but Kathleen Turner, Director of Preservation North Carolina's Durham office, thinks more could be done to reduce the number of houses that are being torn down, and that could help stabilize the neighborhood. More diverse housing stock allows for a more diverse population living there, she said. Earlier this decade, Turner explains, Preservation North Carolina renovated blighted homes in East Durham that seemed to be in a terrible shape, but were in fact quite fixable, and wound up highly sought after by home buyers. The houses should be examined on a one-by-one basis. Just because it's built in the 20s or 30s doesn't mean it's substandard, she said. Of course, those east of Durham homes lay in a National Historic District, which means there was a federal tax incentive to renovate them. East End has no such designation, nor does South Side. If the city or community organizations worked to get that area listed as historic, there'd be a profit motive to fix them up rather than demolish them. And that's the kind of thing builders like Little and Thayer pay attention to. After all, says Turner, what's at stake is no less than the flavor and future of Durham. A great deal of Durham's current success and attractiveness is its community character, its architecture, and the history and people, she says. You start slashing and burning, where does it all lead? It's a delicate balancing act. Turning now to the food section. One raviolo at a time. After 7 years at farmers markets, Molina's Fresh Pasta opens a storefront honoring the founder's Italian roots. Last week, a relative calm eased into the kitchen of Molina's Fresh Pasta. It's a stark contrast to the grand opening buzz of the new store a few weeks earlier. Owner and pasta maker Carmela Alvera is enjoying a rare day off. But as she sits at a cleared-off table, sharing tales of how she got her start as a pasta maker, it's easy to imagine the mixtures churning pasta, cutting machines whirling, and an entire staff diligently shredding mushrooms and zesting less lemons for the ravioli fillings. I think being the daughter of immigrants, my parents, also wanted to see the next generation go from being hard labor like this to maybe an office job, she says, as she gestures toward the pasta-making machines outfitting her new production space and shop. Like many first-generation Americans, Avera has childhood memories that revolve around food traditions that followed her parents from their native Calabria, Italy, to their now adoptive home of Syracuse, New York. My dad still gardens. They make wine. They make bread. They cure meats. They do everything that the hipsters are doing now, but before it was cool, says Alvara, laughing. I grew up in that environment where you make your own food, where food is important, and eating dinner together is important. Honoring these traditions, Alvara opened Melina's Fresh Pasta in 2010. She started by delivering a few coolers of ravioli and gnocchi to Triangle area farmers markets, then expanded to retail distribution with Weaver Street Market in 2013 and to select Whole Foods in 2015. On December 2nd, she finally opened a brick-and-mortar location just past Durham's Lakewood neighborhood. It wasn't a straight shot from canning tomato sauce to creating a signature lemon ricotta ravioli. After graduating with a degree in political science from Colgate University, Alvara lived in Washington, D.C. for 12 years before moving to Raleigh. She was working a sales and marketing job, likely for her parents' approval, and completely bored. For a mental break, she packed her bags for Italy to attend pasta-making school. The guy from Master of None stole my idea, she says, referring to Aziz Ansari's Netflix show in which his character leaves New York City to make pasta in Italy and clear his head. At Bologna, a family-owned Bologna-based food tour company and cooking school, Alvara learned to make sfoglia, a traditional fresh egg pasta. Once she mastered the dough, her teacher, Francesca, taught her to roll it out using a mattarello, which is the pasta rolling pin that now hangs next to her menu board. Alvara also learned how to hand-shape pasta like bow tie-shaped farfalls and tubular, folders of which flank the menu's other side. Her handmade pasta repertoire expanded to include traditional lasagna, bolognese, gnocchi, ravioli, and tortellini, a regional specialty typically served in brodo, that's in broth. I was a little mortified when she took out the beef tongue to make the broth to serve the tortellini in. It was very traditional, she said, but the experience, beef tongue notwithstanding, turned out to be about more than making pasta. It started out as very transactional. I'm going to pay you to teach me to make pasta, and it turned into a friendship, Alvara says. They, the Torre family, Raffaella, Marcello, and Francesca, took me in for a week where it was just me and their family. They became my mentors. When Marcello drove her to the train station at the end of the week, he revealed that everyone thought he was crazy for starting food and a travel business. Alvara recalls him saying, I shouldn't listen to anybody who tells me not to start a food business. If I want to do it, I should do it. A seed was planted. Alvara returned to her sales and marketing job in Raleigh and continued marketing pasta as a hobby. In 2010, she started selling small quantities of her artisanal pasta at the Wake Forest Farmers Market and at the Carborough Market in the following spring. Around this time, she received a phone call from Charleston-based pasta maker who was retiring and wanted to sell his equipment. Alvara politely declined, explaining that she wanted to make pasta by hand. But when she made her Carborough Market debut and sold out the pasta it had taken her 1 week to make in 1 hour, she quickly changed her mind. Even though the machines expedited part of the pasta-making process, Alvara officially quit her job in 2012 to focus on making pasta full-time. She eventually outgrew the detached garage-turning-commercial kitchen at her North Durham home. She held out for the light-flooded space on Chapel Hill Road. Melina's Fresh Pasta Shop's open floor plan and expanded production area allow each piece of equipment, including a 300-pound mixer, to have its own place, storied for industrial-sized cans of San Marzano-style tomatoes and 50-pound sacks of Durham and Semolina, and a small staff lounge. The improved workflow also allows Alvaro to create new ravioli fillings like Southwestern-inspired black bean or goat cheese and honey, which are available for purchase from the shop's modest retail space along with a full range of cut and stuffed pastas, sauces, and takeout and bake meals. The open floor plan also allows room for hosting tours, pasta-making classes, and monthly tastings. Alvaro's business has come a long way over the last 7 years, but she hasn't forgotten her roots. She fondly recounts how her family devoted several days every August to pick bushels of tomatoes and canned tomato sauce for the year ahead. "I think I was only allowed to put the basil in the jar. I wasn't allowed to do anything else," she said. Now she's responsible for making about 70 pints of fresh tomato basil sauce every week to sell alongside her pastas or layer into the baked pasta dishes. So, what did her parents make of all this? "They're excited," Alvaro says. "I think it was maybe their influence that caused this, watching them entertain and feed everyone my whole life. We're all doing things to help people. My brother is a fire captain. My sister runs a hospital lab. And I feed people." And now from the music section, Lofty Ambitions. Carborough's Music Loft closed at the end of December, but a successor is already taking shape. The reality that physical retail stores, big and small, are struggling all over the U.S. is not exactly big news in 2018. Still, when Carborough's Music Loft closed near the end of December, many musicians in the community were stunned and saddened. Some felt as though a friend had died. As someone who worked there for 2 years, I felt this loss, too. Though rumors of the closure had been swirling around for a few weeks, there was no official word, prior announcement, or anything about a no-going-out-of-business sale to soften the blow. On December 31st, a few days after word got out that the shop was closed for good, co-owners Jim and Kathy Dennis posted a statement on Facebook. It said, "Relationships in music are powerful, which is why it is so hard to have to tell you all that we are not going to be able to have the same relationship we have cherished for so many years." It read in part, "Sadly, as the New Year is approached, we have had to make the very difficult decision to close our doors." The post included contact information for those who wanted to pick up their consignment items or to receive payment for consignments that were sold. Jim and Kathleen Dennis bought the business from its owner, founder Jay Miller, in 2002, and Miller became the store's landlord. In recent months, both Jim and Kathleen have been dealing with serious medical issues. "What is important to me is spending time with my wife, living my life, and being around the people I love." Jim Dennis said, "I ran that store for a long time, and I helped a lot of people, and I'm very proud of what I did. It was just the right time to walk away." Miller says that if he wanted to, he could advertise the Carborough space now to the general public and have it rented out within 30 days, but he won't. The better news is that a new project that includes a music store is very likely open in that spot at 116 West Main Street. Miller is currently trying to work out something new with some former Music Loft employees, as well as guitar repair specialist Brian McGee, who shared rented space with the store's guitar teacher, Brian Dennis, no relation, who also used space there, and Frank Worrell, who runs the Creative Music Studios Cooperative next door to the Music Loft. "We all have a stake in how this goes," Worrell said. Miller said he's very interested in collaborating with Worrell, whom he's known for a long time and who is already a tenant. "There's talk of using the Music Loft space as part of an expanded music hub that would include a smaller store, repair work, lots of teaching, and studio space." "It would be pretty cool," because it would be a place where you could go to rehearse, you could record, you could take lessons, you could buy things. Miller already owned music lofts in Durham and Greensboro when he purchased B&B Music in 1985 and made it the third store in his chain. Eventually, he moved it to Carrboro because the rent was low and he wanted to be near the art center. While I was there, Carrboro experienced a renaissance that I attribute more than anyone else to then-Mayor Ellis Kennard. He recalls of that period from the late 80s to the mid-90s, when he was considering a move back to Chapel Hill. Kennard convinced him to stay and set up with a renovation loan from the town to spruce up the Main Street building where the loft has operated since. Brian Settle goes back 23 years with the music loft, having worked at the long-defunct Durham location before working in Carrboro until its closure. He points to the 2008 recession as the doomsday event that taken a lot of music shops. The store never really recovered from that, he said. Finally, people stopped coming in, which made it hard to pay the bills. So what makes aspiring music store owners think they can make a buck off a bad trend? For one thing, several Triangle music stores have survived and even flourished, mostly because of a community-used term in that world, service. Why is Guitar Center doing these things in the lessons? Because it's a service, Dennis said. You can't order a service from Amazon. You can't order dog food from Amazon. You can order dog food from Amazon. For Elia Madden, the talented young singer-songwriter and guitarist for Carrboro band Cosmic Punk, the best part of the Music Loft service was free advice, offered without condescension. What I really liked about the Music Loft is that Jim and all the other people that worked there didn't really think that any question was a stupid question, Madden says. No matter what type of music store the Main Street eventually becomes, music store will be missed. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So, until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.